out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system at radioarian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is St. George's Day. It's the 23rd of April 2018. It's a Monday. Happy St. George's Day to all our English listeners. I was going to talk a little bit about feminism today before I realised what the actual date was. So I think what I'll do now instead is talk about St. George for this episode, because most people don't really know that much about him, and he is quite an interesting character, and he does have a link with Great Britain. And the story of that is a link with Constantine the Great, who was a king of Britain. Of course, some people say that Constantine wasn't British. He was to do with, I think it was one of the Slavic nations. But we do have our own British history of Constantine the Great. He was a British king. And the fact that we have St. George as our patron saint, that does tend to point to the story of Constantine being our British king, being the truthful one. Now, the story starts with St. George's father, who served with great distinction under the Emperor Diocletian. And St. George was born round about 280 AD, and his father dies, and St. George is about 12 years old when his father dies. And he was born in Palestine. He was born in a place called Leda in Palestine. And when his father dies, someone from the Roman Empire says, well, we'll take your son off your hands to George's mother, and says, and we will teach him to fight, and we'll put men under him, and he can serve the emperor the same as his father did, since his father fought with such distinction, and he came from noble parents as well. They were of the noble class, so he was obviously quite high up in the army, and he fought in the Persian Wars. It was actually in the Persian Wars that he met Constantine the Great. Now, I've got some quotes from a book called George of Leda, Soldier, Saint and Marcher by Isabel Hill Elder, and I'll read the bits that concern Britain because they're quite interesting. And this starts at page 20, and this is after he's been serving the emperor and fighting for the emperor, and he's about 20 years old. Quote, when St. George had completed his 20th year, he was so exceedingly strong and valiant that he was the leader in battle, and there was no one among all the company of soldiers who could be compared with him for strength and beauty. And the grace of God was with him, and he gave him beauty and strength, that all those who saw him marvelled at his power and youth, and God was with him in all his ways. The manuscripts of contemporary date agree with the traditional history of St. George. They record a youth of much beauty of person and an exquisite courtesy. Such was the foundation upon which was built the character of the patron saint of England, the soldier marcher without compare in the annals of Christian history. From his first military appointment, St. George enjoyed the favour of the Emperor Diocletian, who sought to recompense the loyal services of his father by advancing the son in a series of rapid promotions, until finally he made him military tribune of the Imperial Guard. St. George served under Galerius in the Persian campaign, which lasted 2 years, and is said at the end of hostilities to have taken up his residence at Beirut as a wealthy patrician or tribune of the people. His sojourn there was of sufficient duration to permit of his name being associated for all time with Beirut. its bay is still known as the Bay of St. George. His companion in arms, Constantine, returned to his father, Constantius, at York, where he is believed to have remained until after the death of his father in that city, AD 306. St. George, in the course of his military duties at Beirut, appears to have been sent by Diocletian on an expedition to Britain. Of many Roman legions and auxiliary cohorts which came over to Britain from the continent and Palestine, we have little record, least of all the expeditions sent by Diocletian, the Roman Empire being on the wane, since the division of the empire into four parts, and never revived, even under its consolidation by Constantine the Great. The tradition which associates St. George with Britain is meagre in the extreme. Dr. Clapton suggests that St. George sailed through the Irish Sea, subsequently known as St. George's Channel, and landed at Porta Sisuntiorum, which was then the only port on that part of the coast, afterwards called the County of Lancaster. Arrived at his immediate destination, the court of Constantius Chlorus at York, and the home of his comrade in arms, Constantine, the welcome extended to the young Christian soldier by the Empress Helena can be imagined. This traditional visit to York was given a lasting commemoration, for over its gate still hangs the shield, blazoned with the heraldry of its prime, the red cross on the silver ground, the sign of St. George. Of the duties deputed to St. George in Britain, there is no record. The traditions of this expedition centre around the church at Glastonbury, to which at that time, and through the centuries up to the Reformation, pilgrimages were made on account of its reputed sanctity as the first church in Britain. The native church of Britain had, from its inception, grown steadily and spread to all parts of the country. The zealous young Christian St. George would find fellowship among the British Christians, and, according to tradition, made a pilgrimage to Glastonbury, the burial place of Joseph of Arimathea, whose home, Ramah or Arimathea, was in close proximity to his own at Leda. Some authorities say that Joseph was his kinsman. Local tradition also associates the name of St. George with Caerleon on Usk, on the other side of the Severn, the headquarters of the 2nd Roman Legion, and most probably connected with a military expedition on which he was engaged. Caerleon on Usk was in the Roman division of the country, the capital of Britannia Secunda. Here, the Roman governor resided and had his palace. Here also the courts were held, where the imperial edicts were promulgated. By the Romans it was called Isca Colonia, and Civitas Legionis Second Augustae. Quote, "Those cities which had the title of Augusta conferred upon them were the chief metropoli of the province." Close quote. Giraldus Cambrensis, in the 12th century, writing of its remains in his time, attests its pristine magnificence and mentions immense palaces with gilded roofs. Here, before the Roman invasion, Caradoc held his court. It was the seat of an archdruid, and subsequently became an archiepiscopal see, the changeover from Druidism to Christianity having taken place about the year AD 182. Caerleon on Usk was therefore a place of importance from a remote age. St. George, with his fellow Christians in Caerleon, received with consternation the publication of the Edict of Diocletian for the extermination of the Christians. For some years, the persecution had raged on the continent of Europe, and now it was extended to Britain. With Diocletian, St. George had ever been on terms of friendship, and it was with full reliance on that friendship that the young soldier decided to go directly to the emperor and plead for the lives of his fellow Christians, and to obtain for them, if possible, freedom of worship. Without delay, he returned to Leda, freed his slaves, sold his possessions with the exception of his house at Leda, and distributed the proceeds among his household. Two of his servants he retained, besides his body servant, Pasicrates. To this faithful and devoted servant, we owe much of the knowledge we possess of the subsequent happenings to the soldier saint, whom he calls Mar George, or Lord George. According to Gibbon, Christianity grew and flourished during the first 20 years of the reign of Diocletian, and it was not until Galerius had conquered the Persians that any serious check was put upon it. Diocletian, as the elder and supreme emperor, was an active, benevolent, clear-sighted statesman and ruler, but also a zealous adherent of the old religion. As such, he was inclined to hold Christianity responsible for many of the internal troubles of his kingdom. He was restrained from interfering with the Christians, however, by the policy of toleration, which had now prevailed for some time, and by the political consideration of the vast number of the Christian population. Yet the incessant importunities and whispered suspicions of Galerius were not without success. In AD 298, he issued the decree that all soldiers should take part in the sacrificial rites. He thus obliged all Christian soldiers to withdraw from the army. Galerius finally prevailed upon the emperor to order a general persecution, yet even then Diocletian persisted that in it no blood should be shed. An edict was issued forbidding all Christian assemblies and ordering the destruction of churches, the burning of the sacred scriptures, and depriving Christians of their offices and civil rights. Stripped of his armour, military rank, and worldly possessions, St. George prepared to take the journey to Nicomedia, on the shores of the Bosphorus, where the Emperor Diocletian had gone from Rome to pass the winter with Galerius Maximus, Emperor of the East, and to confer with him as to their future course with regards to the Christians. There is very little trace of any mass of pagan public opinion hostile to the Christians. Their persecution was almost entirely an official one. The Christian habit of giving rather than seeking to acquire was certainly among the novelties which impressed the public opinion of the Roman age. Constantine stated that when very young, he heard Diocletian express himself respecting those righteous ones on earth, and that one of the pagan priests then present replied that they were the Christians. Close quote. Well, what happens after that? There's a fire that breaks out in the imperial palace, and Galerius blames the Christians for that, and then the persecution really begins to rage throughout the whole of the Roman Empire, and they start killing the Christians and martyring them, and eventually that makes its way to Britain. And St. George decides that he's going to appeal to Diocletian on behalf of the Christians, but Galerius is there as well, and despite how good a soldier he was and how loyal he was to the Roman Empire, he was tortured, and they tried to get him to recant, and he refused to recant, and all sorts of horrible tortures, boiling lead being poured on him and nails being hammered into his head. There's all sorts of reports of these really vicious tortures that went on. And eventually he was killed, he was martyred, I believe he was beheaded eventually at the end of it all. But before that actually happened, he managed to convert, I believe it was a daughter of the emperor. And then shortly after he actually died, the emperor himself dies, Diocletian dies. And then Constantine the Great, the king in Britain, he gets crowned king in Britain because his father dies, Constantius Chlorus. And he then goes to Rome with a British army and claims his place as emperor. And as soon as he is emperor, he makes Christianity the official religion of the empire. Because before that it was tolerated, then it was persecuted, and he makes it the religion of the empire. And the reason for that is because Britain, as we learned from that quote earlier, had been Christian since 180 AD. And we're now talking about the year 300, maybe a bit further on than that. So King Constantine was brought up to be a Christian by Empress Helena, which is obviously why when he went to Rome, he was already a Christian. I mean, he may well have seen a symbol of the cross, what have you, along with the legends that go along with it. But the fact is, he would have been brought up to be a Christian. And that's the origin of why he turned Rome into a Christian empire. And this is also why he made all these churches that were dedicated to St. George, because St. George was his friend. St. George was the guy that he had fought alongside. St. George had come to see him in Britain. And that's why England is our patron saint. And he also made St. George the model for the male youth of the empire, because he held up under such fortitude. He fought well. He was generous. He gave all his goods away before he went to see Diocletian. He refused to recant underneath all this torture and eventually died as a martyr. He had a perfect life, and he wanted to encourage the young men of Europe to wish to emulate him, to do the same, to be inspired by him. I mean, the battle cries later on was for St. George, for St. George and country, king and country. It's always about this character, St. George, because of his bravery. And there was a church that his mother, St. Helena, that she built in Jerusalem, that was still there. There was one, I think there was one in Constantinople as well. I know there was one in Jerusalem. And his hand was, St. George's hand was supposedly in a church in Libya. And when the recent war took place in Libya, the jihadists went into the church, desecrated the church, and destroyed the relic. The hand of St. George, we actually had that as a witness to the fact that this all actually happened. And these reports that I was quoting from there, they're taken from the reports of the saints and people that were actually writing at that time. Now, the dragon that he supposedly slayed, the dragon, some people believe that that was Galerius, and that by his death and by refusing to recant, the public opinion changed as to why Christianity should be persecuted. And by his death, he slew the dragon that was persecuting Christianity. And shortly afterwards, Constantine became king and made it legal. There's also another belief that it's to do with the woman that he managed to convert into Christianity, that was the daughter of Diocletian. But there are other links with it, because we also have the mythical aspect to St. George. The actual name itself, George, begins with G-E-O, which is the source of the word geology, and geography means to do with the earth, means to do like an earth spirit or a vegetation spirit. And St. George is associated in the Middle East with the color green, and they call him Al-Khidr in Islam, the green one. He's supposed to be this green angel. And there's a crossover between these myths of the green man, which is the vegetation god, and the myths of St. George. And of course, in Britain, there are actually more representations of the green man in the churches than there actually are representations of Jesus Christ. It's a very common symbol to see, is the symbol of the green man. And he's associated with St. George. And we also had our Mummer's plays, which I've spoken of before on Radio Arian. And one of the most famous ones, one of the most well-liked ones, was St. George and the Turk. And the Turk was obviously a Muslim, and the Muslim had stolen a white woman, and obviously for sex slavery. And St. George killed the Turk and rescued the girl from the Turk, rescued the maiden from this foul Turk. And that was a very popular mummer's play. And of course, this is where we probably a crossover with the idea that St. George was always usually rescuing a virgin from the dragon. The dragon would, in myths, the dragon would have the young maiden tied up and ready to be devoured by the dragon. And St. George would slay the dragon and release the virgin and marry her. Well, she would be a princess or what have you. So then you have a crossover with this St. George and the Turk, and instead of a mythical dragon, St. George is actually fighting against the Muslims, because they sailed to Europe and snatched white women and took them away into slavery. So it seems that whatever the age we have been living in, St. George has taken on the form of the defender of white people, and the defender of white women, particularly against the dragon, against evil, against Satan, and embodies the spirit of the white man. This is fairly important, because now that the Middle East and Palestine and Ephesus and Constantinople are now all filled with Turk men, they will try to tell you that St. George was a Turk. They'll try to tell you that he was brown-skinned. He's quite clearly not brown-skinned. I mean, this guy fought with distinction. It tells you that he came from a very, very noble family. And nobody brown-skinned would ever be described as coming from a noble family. And the King of Britain and the Emperor of Rome is not going to be elevating some mongrel brown Arab into the patron saint of England. You know, it had to be white, it had to be European. There was a sense of brotherhood among the white people. Even at this time, there was a sense of the white aristocracy, particularly. When you think of kings and how they would intermarry with other European royalty. Because we knew that we did all come from the same place. We knew that all the Europeans came from originally from the same family. I mean, we may have got different cultures, we may have grown to have different languages through different selective breeding. We may have had more people with blonde hair in some regions and more people with red hair in other regions. But that's all that was selective breeding. And St. George went on to become very important to the royal family in Britain, and we had the Order of the Garter, the Order of the Blue Garter, and which was a chivalrous order. He became like a badge of chivalry. Probably because of rescuing the woman from the dragon. He's also involved with the stories of Arthur and the knights of the 12, Arthur and the Round Table, and Arthur's 12 knights. St. George is important in that, and perhaps he plays the role of the green knight in that, because of this link with green that we hear about. And I'll read you some more quotes just to explain how important St. George was with the early growth of Christianity. Once the Roman Empire had accepted it as the official religion of the empire. And again, this is from George of Leda, Soldier, Saint and Marcher by Isabel Hill Elder. And this is from page 59. Upon the site of the place of execution where St. George was beheaded, Constantine and his mother, Queen Helena, erected a church which at the present time is used for Mohammedan worship and known as the Mosque of St. George. See, this is why we've had this crossover where St. George is now honoured by the Shiites, I believe. I don't think the Sunni guys would. But upon the site of the shrine erected over the remains of St. George at Leda, Constantine built his magnificent Byzantine church. Constantine is known to have dedicated 21 churches to the honour of St. George. That at Leda is referred to in the Greek Menology in the following words. Not long after the death of St. George, religion, then beginning to shine gloriously, and Constantine, the pious emperor then reigning, such as was devoted both to the gospel of Christ and the martyr, built at Leda a beautiful and magnificent temple to his honour, translating thither the blessed corpse out of the obscure corner where it had been buried. A temple of so high esteem that the feast of the dedication of it was kept holy, and so continued to succeeding generations. The first church in Jerusalem, dedicated to St. George, is said to have been erected by the Empress Helena, near to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, at the time of her sojourn in Jerusalem in AD 326. In the opinion of the archaeologist Dr. Conrad Schick, the tradition is based upon the truth. In the calendar of the Eastern Church, the Empress Helena and her son are always united. Churches were erected at Helena's instigation and at Constantine's cost. In Britain, a church was erected by Constantine to the memory of Saint Amphibolus, one of the victims of the Diocletian persecution, when 10,000 Christians at Caerleon on Usk alone perished with their teachers. The memory of the Emperor Constantine as the founder of the Church of Saint Amphibolus at Winchester was preserved until Commonwealth times by his sword, laid up in the great reliquary of the cathedral. This is the first recorded instance of a sword laid up in a sacred building. Close quote. Now, the actual imagery of St. George spearing the dragon, that goes way back. That goes way back into Egyptian times. And we have images of Horus spearing a dragon or spearing a crocodile. And it's quite interesting. One of the images of Horus spearing the crocodile is Horus dressed up as a Roman soldier spearing the crocodile. And then it goes back to the spearing of, Apophis, I think it is, when you've got the gods in the bark, the ark, some kind of boat, and they're spearing the serpent in the waves. So this imagery of spearing the serpent goes back a long, long way. And of course, we also have St. Michael who spears the dragon, but St. Michael is an angel. He's a supernatural being. St. George was supposedly a human being, but he took on aspects of these earlier gods, such as Horus and other ones, and anything that was associated with green or anything that slew the dragon. And as I say, and on into modern times with the Mummers plays with St. George fighting against the Turk, where the Turk took the place of the dragon or the devil. And St. George today is still we're very proud of him in England. It's a great shame that we don't have a public holiday on St. George's Day. We should have celebration of St. George. But of course, we've been told that to celebrate St. George is racist. And now you know all the history of St. George, you can understand why it's racist, because it's against Islam. It's against Muslims. It's against them taking our white women. And it's about fighting in the army against the Persians and against others. And of course, it's Christian. It's a Christian saint, so they don't want us to be honouring anything to do with Christianity. But he was a very brave man, a very, very chivalrous man. And we have this strong link with him through King Constantine and the history of St. George. You know, it proves that Constantine was a British king. And that he fought with him in these wars. The hidden history of Britain is absolutely fascinating, especially the hidden history of the church, which modern churches would rather you didn't know about. But there is reference to Christianity in Britain going right back to Joseph of Arimathea coming straight over here after the resurrection of Christ. And I don't believe it's just a coincidence that both Christianity and Druidry were banned by the Empire. There was a link between the two. And it was a very smooth transition from Druidry to Christianity as well. There's no record of any antagonism. As the quote said, in the book that I was just quoting from, about how there wasn't any antagonism from the people. It was always state oppression from Rome. It wasn't from the actual people themselves, because, you know, the Christians were good people to be around. They wanted to be upstanding and honourable, decent white people. They wanted to live to their best that they possibly could be. They wanted to live to their full potential, which is a national socialist ideal. It's a white ideal, and it's also a Christian ideal. Anyway, so here's to St. George and St. George's Day, and I hope you enjoy the rest of it and have a toast to him later. Thank you all for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with Nat Danelaw. God bless and hail victory.